The Maya story has several advantages for all of us interested in prehistoric collapses. Our other past societies consist disproportionately of small societies in somewhat fragile and geographically isolated environments, and behind the cutting edge of contemporary technology and culture. The Maya were none of those things. Instead, they were culturally the most advanced society in the pre-Columbian New World, the only one with extensive preserved writing, and located within one of the two heartlands of New World civilization. While their environment did present some problems associated with its terrain and unpredictably fluctuating rainfall, it does not rank as notably fragile. The Maya warn us that crashes can also befall the most advanced and creative societies. From the perspective of our 5-point framework for understanding societal collapses, the Maya illustrate 4 of our points. They did damage their environment, especially by deforestation and erosion. Climate changes, droughts, did contribute to the Maya collapse, probably repeatedly. Hostilities among the Maya themselves did play a large role. Finally, political, cultural factors, especially the competition among kings and nobles that led to a chronic emphasis on war and erecting monuments rather than on solving underlying problems, also contributed. The remaining item on our 5-point list, trade or cessation of trade with external friendly societies, does not appear to have been essential in sustaining the Maya or in causing their downfall. To understand the Maya, let's begin by considering their environment, which we think of as jungle or tropical rainforest. That's not true, and the reason why not proves to be important. Properly speaking, tropical rainforests grow in high rainfall equatorial areas that remain wet or humid all year round. But the Maya homeland lies more than 1,000 miles from the equator, in a habitat termed a seasonal tropical forest. That is, while there does tend to be a rainy season from May to October, there is also a dry season from January through April. From north to south in the Yucatan Peninsula, rainfall increases from 18 to 100 inches per year, and the soils become thicker, so that the southern peninsula was agriculturally more productive and supported denser populations. But rainfall in the Maya homeland is unpredictably variable between years. Some recent years have had 3 or 4 times more rain than other years. Also, the timing of rainfall within the year is somewhat unpredictable. As a result, modern farmers attempting to grow corn in the ancient Maya homelands have faced frequent crop failures, especially in the north. The ancient Maya were presumably more experienced and did better, but nevertheless, they too must have faced risks of crop failures. Although southern Maya areas received more rainfall than northern areas, problems of water were paradoxically more severe in the south. In the northern Yucatan Peninsula, the elevation is sufficiently low that the ancient Maya were able to reach the water table at deep sinkholes called cenotes, or at deep caves. But much of the south lies too high above the water table for cenotes or wells to reach down to it. Making matters worse, most of the Yucatan Peninsula consists of karst, a porous sponge-like limestone terrain where rain runs straight into the ground and where little or no surface water remains available. How did those dense southern Maya populations deal with their resulting water problem? They excavated depressions, modified natural depressions, and plugged up leaks in the karst by plastering the bottoms of the depressions in order to create cisterns and reservoirs, which collected rain from large plastered catchment basins and stored it for use in the dry season. For example, reservoirs at the Maya city of Tikal held enough water to meet the drinking water needs of about 10,000 people for a period of 18 months. But the inhabitants of Tikal would still have been in deep trouble if 18 months passed without rain. A shorter drought in which they exhausted their stored food supplies might already have gotten them in deep trouble through starvation, because growing crops required rain rather than reservoirs. Of particular importance for our purposes are the details of Maya agriculture, which was based on crops domesticated in Mexico. For the elite, as well as commoners, corn constituted at least 70% of the Maya diet, as deduced from isotope analysis of ancient Maya skeletons. Their sole domestic animals were the dog, turkey, Muscovy duck, and a stingless bee yielding honey, while their most important wild meat source was deer, plus fish at some sites. However, the few animal bones at Maya archaeological sites suggest that the quantity of meat was low. Venison was mainly a luxury food for the elite. It was formerly believed that Maya farming was based on slash-and-burn agriculture, so-called Swidden agriculture, in which forest is cleared and burned, crops are grown in the resulting field for a year or a few years until the soil is exhausted, and then the field is abandoned for 15 or 20 years until regrowth of wild vegetation restores fertility to the soil. Thus, it was a surprise for archaeologists to discover that ancient Maya population densities were often far higher than what Swidden agriculture could support. The actual values are the subject of much dispute, but frequently cited estimates reach 250 to 750, possibly even 1,500 people per square mile. Hence, the ancient Maya must have had some means of increasing agricultural production beyond what was possible through Swidden alone. Many Maya areas do show remains of agricultural structures designed to increase production, such as terracing, irrigation systems, and arrays of canals and drained or raised fields. However, other Maya areas show little such archaeological evidence. Their inhabitants must have used archaeologically invisible means to increase food production by mulching, floodwater farming, shortening the time that a field is left fallow, or in the extreme, omitting the fallow period entirely and growing crops every year, or in especially moist areas, growing two crops per year. Socially stratified societies, including modern American and European society, consist of farmers who produce food, plus non-farmers who merely consume the food. The number of non-producing consumers that can be supported depends on the society's agricultural productivity. In the United States today, farmers make up only 2% of our population, and each farmer can feed on the average 125 other people. Ancient Egyptian agriculture was efficient enough for an Egyptian peasant to produce 5 times the food required for himself and his family, but a Maya peasant could produce only twice the needs of himself and his family. That's because Maya agriculture suffered from several limitations. First, it yielded little protein. Corn has a lower protein content than the old world staples of wheat and barley. Another limitation arose from the humid climate, which made it difficult to store corn beyond a year. Finally, the Maya had no animal-powered transport or plows. All overland transport went on the backs of human porters. But if you send out a porter carrying a load of corn to accompany an army into the field, some of that load of corn is required to feed the porter himself on the trip out, and some more to feed him on the trip back, leaving only a fraction of the load available to feed the army. Beyond a march of a few days to a week, it becomes uneconomical to send porters carrying corn to provision armies or markets. Thus, the modest productivity of Maya agriculture and their lack of draft animals severely limited the duration and the distance possible for their military campaigns. Food supply considerations may contribute to explaining why Maya society remained divided among small kingdoms that were perpetually at war with each other and never became unified into large empires like the Aztec Empire of the Valley of Mexico or the Inca Empire of the Andes. Many Maya kingdoms held populations of only up to 25,000 to 50,000 people, none over 500,000, within a radius of 2 or 3 days' walk from the king's palace. Now for a quick crash course in Maya history. The Maya area is part of the larger ancient Native American cultural region known as Mesoamerica, which extended approximately from central Mexico to Honduras and constituted, along with the Andes of South America, one of the 2 New World centers of innovation before European arrival. The Maya shared much in common with other Mesoamerican societies, not only in what they possessed, but also in what they lacked. For example, Mesoamerican societies lacked metal tools, pulleys and other machines, wheels, boats with sails, and domestic animals large enough to carry loads or pull a plow. All of those great Maya temples were constructed by stone and wooden tools and by human muscle power alone. Within the Maya area, villages and pottery appeared around or after 1000 BC, substantial buildings around 500 BC. And writing around 400 BC. All preserved ancient Maya writing, a total of about 15,000 inscriptions, is on stone and pottery and deals with kings, nobles, and their conquests. There is not a single mention of commoners. The ancient Maya also had bark paper books, but only decayed remains of them have survived in tombs. The famous Maya long count calendar begins on August 11, 3114 BC, just as our own calendar begins on January 1st of the first year of the Christian era. We know the significance to us of that day zero of our calendar. Presumably, the Maya also attached some significance to their own day zero, but we don't know what it was. Our calendar is divided into units of days, weeks, months, years, decades, centuries, and millennia. Similarly, the Maya long count calendar named dates in units of days, kin, 20 days, eunal, 360 days, tun, 7,200 days, or approximately 20 years, katun, and 144,000 days, or approximately 400 years, baktun. The classic period of Maya civilization begins in Baktun 8, around AD 250, when evidence for the first kings and dynasties appears. In Maya society, the king also functioned as high priest, carrying the responsibility to attend to astronomical and calendrical rituals, and thereby to bring rain and prosperity, which the king claimed to have the supernatural power to deliver because of his asserted family relationship to the gods. From 250 onwards, the Maya population, the number of monuments and buildings, and the number of long count dates on monuments and pottery increased almost exponentially, to reach peak numbers in the 8th century. Numbers of all three of those indicators of a complex society declined throughout the 9th century, until the last known long count date on any monument fell in the year AD 909. That decline of Maya population, architecture, and the long count calendar constitutes what is known as the classic Maya collapse. As an example of the collapse, let's consider in more detail a small but densely built city whose ruins now lie in western Honduras at a site known as Copan and described in two recent books by archaeologist David Webster. For agricultural purposes, the best land in the Copan area consists of five pockets of flat land with fertile alluvial soil along a river valley with a tiny total area of only 10 square miles. Much of the land around Copan consists of steep hills. Soil in the hills is less fertile, more acidic, and poorer in phosphate than valley soil. As judged by numbers of house sites, population growth in the Copan Valley rose steeply from the 5th century up to a peak estimated at around 27,000 people at AD 750 to 900. Construction of royal monuments was especially massive between 650 and 750. After 700, nobles other than kings began erecting their own palaces, of which there are about 20 by the year 800, when one of those palaces is known to have consisted of 50 buildings, with room for about 250 people. All of those nobles would have increased the burden imposed on the peasants. The last big buildings at Copan were put up around 800, and the last long count date on an incomplete altar has the date of 822. Archaeological surveys of different types of habitats in the Copan Valley show that they were occupied in a regular sequence. The first area farmed were the bottomland pockets. During that time, the human population was growing, but there was not yet occupation of the hills. Hence, that increased population must have been accommodated by intensifying production in the bottomland pockets by some combination of shorter fallow periods, double cropping, and possibly some irrigation. By the year 650, people started to occupy the hill slopes, but those hill sites were cultivated only for about a century. What caused that pullback of population from the hills? Excavation of the foundations of buildings in the valley floor showed that they became covered with sediment during the 8th century, meaning that those acidic, infertile hill soils were being carried down into the valley and blanketing the more fertile valley soils, where they would have reduced agricultural yields. The reason for that erosion of the hillsides is clear. The forests that formerly covered them were being cut down. Dated pollen samples show that the pine forests originally covering the upper elevations of the hill slopes were eventually all cleared. Calculation suggests that most of those trees were being burned for fuel, while the rest were used for construction or for making plaster. Besides causing sediment accumulation in the valleys, that deforestation may have begun to cause a man-made drought in the valley bottom, because forests play a major role in water cycling. Hundreds of skeletons recovered from Copan archaeological sites show that the health of Copan's inhabitants deteriorated from 650 to 850, both among the elite and among the commoners, although the health of the commoners was worse. Recall that Copan's population was increasing steeply while the hills were being occupied. The subsequent abandonment of all of those fields and the hills meant that the burden of feeding the extra population now fell increasingly on the valley floor, and that more and more people were competing for the food grown on the 10 square miles of valley bottomland. That would have led to fighting among the farmers themselves for the best land, or for any land. Because Copan's king was failing to deliver on his promises of rain and prosperity in return for the power and luxuries that he claimed, he would have been the scapegoat for this agricultural failure. That may explain why the royal palace was burned around 850. However, the continued production of some luxury goods suggests that some nobles managed to carry on with their lifestyle after the king's downfall until around 975. Copan's total population decreased more gradually than did its signs of kings and nobles. The estimated population in the year 950 was still around 15,000, or 54% of the peak population of 27,000. That population continued to dwindle until there are no more signs of anyone in the Copan Valley by around 1250. The reappearance of pollen from forest trees thereafter provides independent evidence that the valley became virtually empty of people, and that the forests could at last begin to recover. Two phenomena that contributed to Maya collapses require more discussion: the roles of warfare and of drought. Maya warfare was intense, chronic, and unresolvable. The archaeological record shows that wars became more intense and frequent towards the time of the classic collapse. That evidence comes from discoveries of several types: excavations of massive fortifications surrounding many Maya sites, vivid depictions of warfare and captives on stone monuments, and the decipherment of Maya writing, much of which proved to consist of royal inscriptions boasting of conquests. Maya kings fought to take each other captive. Captives were tortured in unpleasant ways, depicted clearly on monuments and murals, such as yanking fingers out of sockets, pulling out teeth, cutting off the lower jaw, trimming off the lips and fingertips, pulling out the fingernails, and driving a pin through the lips, culminating, sometimes several years later, in the sacrifice of the captive in other equally unpleasant ways, such as tying the captive up into a ball, then rolling the captive down the steep stone staircase of a temple. Maya warfare involved several well-documented types of violence: wars between kingdoms, attempts of cities within a kingdom to secede by revolting against the capital, and civil wars, resulting from frequent violent attempts by would-be kings to usurp the throne. The other phenomenon important to understanding Maya collapses is the repeated occurrence of droughts. Based on studies of radiocarbon-dated layers from lake sediment cores, climatologists and paleoecologists conclude that the Maya area was relatively wet from about 5500 BC until 500 BC. The following period, from 475 to 250 BC, was dry. The pre-classic rise may have been facilitated by the return of wetter conditions after 250 BC. But then a drought from AD 125 until 250 was associated with the pre-classic collapse at El Mirador and other sites. That was followed by the resumption of wetter conditions and of the buildup of classic Maya cities. Finally, around 760, there began the worst drought in the last 7,000 years, peaking around the year 800, and suspiciously associated with the classic collapse. In the most naive form of the hypothesis that drought contributed to causing the classic collapse, one could imagine a single drought around 800 triggering the fall of all Maya centers simultaneously. Actually, the classic collapse hit different centers at slightly different times in the period 760 to 910, while sparing other centers. That fact makes many Maya specialists skeptical of a role of drought. But a properly cautious climatologist would not state the drought hypothesis in that oversimplified form. Finer resolution variation in rainfall from one year to the next can be calculated from annually banded sediments that rivers wash into ocean basins near the coast. These yield a conclusion that the drought, around 800, actually had four peaks, the first of them less severe, two dry years around AD 760, then an even drier decade around 810 to 820, three drier years around 860, and six drier years around 910. Interestingly, collapse dates vary among sites and fall into three clusters, in agreement with the dates for the three most severe droughts. The area most affected by the classic collapse was the southern lowlands, probably because it was the area with the densest population and lay too high above the water table for water to be obtained from cenotes or wells when the rains failed. The southern lowlands lost more than 99% of their population in the course of classic collapse. How did such a huge population of millions of people disappear? We infer that some people survived by fleeing to the northern Yucatan, where a rapid population increase took place around the time of the Maya collapse. Some of that population decrease surely involved people dying of starvation or thirst, or killing each other in struggles over increasingly scarce resources. The other part of the decrease may reflect a slower decrease in the birth rate or child survival rate over the course of many decades. To summarize the classic Maya collapse, we can tentatively identify five strands. One strand consisted of population growth outstripping available resources, a dilemma being played out today in Rwanda, Haiti, and elsewhere. Compounding that mismatch between population and resources was the second strand, the effects of deforestation and hillside erosion, which caused a decrease in the amount of usable farmland at a time when more farmland was needed. The third strand consisted of increased fighting, as more and more people fought over fewer resources. Maya warfare peaked just before the collapse. Bringing matters to a head was the strand of climate change. The drought at the time of the classic collapse was not the first drought that the Maya had lived through, but it was the most severe. The landscape was full, and the whole population could not be accommodated in the few areas that continued to have reliable water supplies. As our fifth strand, we have to wonder why the kings and nobles failed to recognize and solve these seemingly obvious problems undermining their society. Their attention was evidently focused on their short-term concerns of enriching themselves, waging wars, erecting monuments, competing with each other, and extracting enough food from the peasants to support all those activities. Like most leaders throughout human history, the Maya kings and nobles did not heed long-term problems insofar as they perceived them.